The only way to bag a classy lady is to give her two tickets to the gun show. And see if she likes the goods.
Okay, kids, here we go. Next seminar up December 8th through the 10th, then February 9th through the 11th. Coaching workshop going on October 21st in Long Island. This is open to anyone with no prerequisites. This is for personal trainers, fitness instructors, or folks that want to casually coach their family and friends. We go over the starting strength methods and principles on barbell training, and participants will take each other through the five-step deadlift setup. There is a discount available for active personal trainers, so check out the link for details. Self-Sufficient Lifter Camp, November 4th in Wichita Falls. Press and Bench Press Camp going on November 11th in Orlando at Starting Strength Orlando. Deadlift and Power Clean Camp, December 2nd on Long Island. Couple Squat and Deadlift Camps, November 4th in Indianapolis at Starting Strength Indianapolis, and then November 12th in Baltimore at 5x3 Training. And finally, Squat, Press, and Deadlift Camps on the list. These are three lift camps going on. Brussels, Belgium at Brussels Barbell, October 21st and December 9th in London. Got a fresh update of top 10 markets that we're looking to put franchise gyms in, so listen up. Looking at Arlington, Virginia, Charlotte, Raleigh, and Durham in North Carolina, Phoenix, Jacksonville, Florida, Kansas City, Missouri, Vegas, Milwaukee, Detroit, and finally Norfolk, Virginia. If you have any interest in those markets, head over to startingstrengthgyms.com, scroll all the way down to the bottom, hit the Own a Gym tab, and find out more information. And as usual, for more info on anything else that I've talked about, head over to startingstrength.com and check out the right-hand side of the homepage.
From the Asgard Company Studios in beautiful Wichita Falls, Texas, from the finest mind in the modern fitness industry, the one true voice in the strength and conditioning profession, the most important podcast on the internet, ladies and gentlemen, Starting Strength Radio.
Welcome back to Starting Strength Radio. This week, we are fortunate to have with us as our guest, Alex Epstein. And Alex is the author of this controversial book, Fossil Future, in which he argues that more, not less, fossil fuel should be made available and used. And he's made a very, very good case for this, and I'll invite you people to just hang on to your chairs here, because we're going to say stuff today that will, you know, disagree with, you know, the narrative. And that's what we like to do here, is disagree with the narrative, because the narrative typically is bullshit. It's complete and utter absolute bullshit. So, Alex, thank you for spending some time with us today. Appreciate your being here on the podcast.
Sure thing.
So, Fossil Future argues that fossil fuels, the energy that we obtain from fossil fuels, is energy that is available to mitigate any damage or harm that might be caused from its own consumption. Is that a fair assessment?
That's a key point, and I think a very underappreciated point.
Yes.
I think it's very helpful to think of technologies in the way we at least properly think of something like a prescription drug or any medical intervention, mm-hmm. where you carefully weigh benefits and side effects, including negative side effects. And people would say, well, it's wrong to just look at the benefits of something and avoid looking at the side effects, because you could make a wrong decision. But by the same token, it's also wrong to just look at side effects, particularly negative side effects, and ignore benefits. I mean, if you did that, you know, you'd never have any surgery. You would never take any medication. But not doing those things, not doing something because it has negative side effects, can be deadly if the benefits far outweigh the negative side effects. So in general, and I'll get to your point in a second, which is a more sophisticated version of this, but in general, you need to carefully weigh the benefits and the side effects of any technology or product. Now, what's distinctive about fossil fuels is they not only have benefits that are very significant, but those benefits can actually cure the negative side effects, which is very rare. Like if you have a surgery or something like that, and there's a potential side effect of some kind of injury, the benefits of the surgery could outweigh that side effect, but they don't cure the side effect, or an antibiotic has a side effect. It doesn't cure its own side effect. Whereas with fossil fuels, take almost any side effect you can imagine of fossil fuels, whether it's climate related, pollution related, whatever, it can in many ways offset and overwhelm those, effectively curing them. So you take something like, let's say, for the sake of argument, fossil fuels increase the incidence of drought. Well, but they also radically increase our ability to irrigate and to move crops from one place to another. And we've seen in the last 100 years, when some people claim we've had more problems with drought or more challenges with drought, the rate of death from drought has gone down over 99%, largely due to the energy and machines we get from fossil fuels. So it's this very special thing where you have to look at the benefits and the side effects. And with fossil fuels and with other forms of energy, the benefits can actually cure the side effects. And so you can have a situation where by using them, every aspect of life gets better, including, I argue, with fossil fuels. The livability of climate has gotten far better, even if fossil fuels do create challenges with climate, because the abilities they give us to overwhelm those challenges far exceed the challenges.
Right. I would... In contrast with your position, my position on this situation, and I've said this several times on this podcast, is that the worry about climate change, global warming, climate change, whatever you want to call it, that whole endeavor is a pseudoscience. It is absolutely a pseudoscience on par with astrology, palmistry, and phrenology, like reading the bumps on your head. It is a pseudoscience because it predicts nothing correctly. In fact, without falsified data, without made up numbers and data that's just absolutely bullshit, the argument goes completely away. And and the other part of that is that makes it a pseudoscience is that it cannot be falsified. And when I say falsified in that context, what I mean is, what could I tell a global warming enthusiast that would make his argument false? And you have to realize there's nothing, because it's not an argument based on science. It is a belief system, in the same way that a religion is a belief system. And there's nothing you can say to these people that are bought in to the, you know, I mean, who are these people in the UK that are sitting down in the street and
just stop oil?
Is there anything you say to any of those kids that would make them say, well, you know, you're right? No, there's nothing. There's no evidence. Look, there's no argument. There's no logic. There's no arithmetic. There's nothing you can say to them to change their mind. It's a pseudoscience. It's a belief system. That's all it is.
Well, so I think part of where I diverge is I think you have to subdivide. When people are talking about the science, it's talked about in a very vague and sloppy way, as if everything people say against fossil fuels and about climate is somehow just one scientific issue. And that's part of what has a religious element to it. It's like, oh, you believe in all of this doctrine or you don't. But so that's wrong. And I do agree there are significant religious elements to it. But I think there are basic things in meteorology and climate science where people do have real knowledge, including I talk about the nature of the greenhouse effect. You have to differentiate that from climate prediction, which is much, much less mature. And you have to differentiate that from what I would call the science of climate livability, which is what's going to happen to how dangerous or how safe climate is. And one of the big fallacies there is people ignore our ability to what I call master climate, to make a dangerous climate safe. Mm-hmm. So what you have is what I think happens is people take the valid science that we do have some warming impact on climate, and then they use that to predict huge changes in a way that's not warranted by science. Mm-hmm. And then they use that to predict that we won't be able to deal with it in a way that totally contradicts our experience, where we've become far safer from climate since we began using fossil fuels. And then they go one step further, which is they say, well, the policy is obviously to get rid of fossil fuels in less than 30 years and replace them specifically with unreliable solar and wind. And that becomes a dogma. So I agree it has a whole religious thing.
That is, anyone that holds that position is just simply innumerate. Because the math doesn't work.
We can talk about that, but I just want to make clear, like, there's not enough, there are not enough distinctions made among different scientific questions. Right. And part of what a scientific field does is it says, okay, here is this question, here's that question. You don't conflate them. Whereas a religious or a political movement, they often just lump they just want science as a word to rubber stamp their policy.
Right.
I think you saw some of this with COVID.
Believe it's not the science. Interest. All of that shit. Believe the science. Believe the science. Well, the science is not settled. There is no such thing as settled science. There is animal.
I think that's you can say that's true in a certain sense, but there's definitely very different degrees of confidence in science. I think the issue with the settled is they claim climate catastrophe is settled, and I would argue it's actually refuted, because we've been emitting CO2 for a long time.
Completely refuted.
And we're better off than ever. But I wouldn't say it's unsettled. I think it's settled that the benefits of fossil fuels far outweigh any negative
side effects. Well, that is a good point. That's a good point. But that when they use the term settled science, they're ignoring the fact that all it takes to disprove the law of gravity would be one example where it didn't work. The science is never settled.
This is the whole thing about philosophy of science, because it's like what you're trying to do with science is you're trying to understand causal relationships.
Right.
And there are real causal relationships, and you're getting at them through inductive generalization. So you're looking at some number of cases and then seeing, okay, how do you ferret out a causal relationship? And then sometimes you can overgeneralize about something, like there are cases that you haven't seen, but it's still true that there is a causal relationship in a large group of things. Maybe there's just a new instance that you don't know of. So this is, I think it's a mistake when they challenge climate catastrophism by just kind of a pure skepticism, because it's too charitable toward climate catastrophism. Climate catastrophism is false, given everything we know about the livability of climate. It's not simply that, it's not like gravity at all. Right? It's not like Newton's law of universal gravitation, where it explains so much.
It's absolutely
not. And then there's something
else
to add. It's like it explains nothing, and it evades our ability to master climate.
Well, the focus for the past 15 years or so, since this pseudoscience really ramped up, has been on CO2. And right now, all across the world, the received wisdom is that CO2 is a deadly poison, and it must be mitigated. We have to stop emitting CO2, or we will destroy the planet. Now, this is just as patent an example of bullshit as is available anywhere in the world. You know, CO2 is, and my background is geology. That's my science background is geology. CO2 right now at 380 parts per million is about as low in the atmosphere in terms of a component of the atmosphere as it's ever been in the history of the world. We have had glacial periods where the CO2 level was at 6,000 parts per million. It's not related to the climate. It's not related to the climate. What it is related to is plant life. It's related to plant life, and it's related to O2, because O2 comes from plant life. That's why we've got oxygen in this atmosphere. And CO2 is plant food. CO2 is added to greenhouses to make the plants grow better. CO2 is plant food. And to equate CO2 with the destruction of this planet is, that's, you know, the harm done by these people is, and you can't, you cannot even talk about this with the vast majority of people on Earth right now, because they are convinced, they are thoroughly convinced that CO2 is a deadly poison.
Well, I think you can talk to people. Some of the points you're making are notable in, I think, revealing something very odd. Because we know, if you tell people, hey, don't you know CO2 is plant food? Everyone knows that. I mean, you learn that at some point in biology class or even earlier than that. And yet we have this idea that if we add more CO2 to the atmosphere, it's going to be all bad.
Right.
There's not even talk of any good. And it's odd because, well, wouldn't it be obvious that it's going to be a greener world? And at least that's better. It's a lot of free fertilizer, so it'll make it easier to grow crops. And then even with warming, if you just think of common sense, most people want it to be warmer than it is.
Right.
People
and engage this is an excellent point in your book.
Warming.
Let's make this right now. When you warm the planet, what gets warmer are the cold places.
Right. They're disproportionately affected
they're
by
disproportionately
warming.
That's even another warming.
That's even another thing most people don't know. But even if they just thought it was equal, you have to know there are a lot of places in the world, at least, that are too cold. And then you look empirically on every single continent, more people die of cold than of heat today.
Right.
And that's after 2 degrees Fahrenheit warming over the past 100+ years. So it just should be problematic in people's minds. Wait a second. Why are we assuming that man-made CO2, even leaving aside all the benefits of the energy we get from fossil fuels, why are we assuming that's all bad? I think what this really shows is there's an anti-human bias in our thinking. There's the idea that if we put the CO2 in the atmosphere, it must be bad. I think when you point that out to people, it wakes them up a little bit and they say, wait a second, oh yeah, I can see why we shouldn't assume it's bad because it's us. We should look at it clinically and say, hey, what's good about this? What's bad about this? And once you do that, then the whole catastrophe thing starts to fade away.
Well, and there you head back into the religious aspects of this argument. It's bad because we did it.
Yeah.
Right? And we're evil because we're humans and we're evil and we need absolution. And the way to get absolution at this point, apparently, is for all of us to stop using our gas stoves.
Yeah, there's always a new one every 3 months. It's a new form of repentance.
Yeah, this you know, and isn't it interesting that every one of those new things always extends the power of the federal government? It's hard to escape
that. That's a non-coincidence. I mean, part of it is, though, if people who want more power over individuals love the idea of universal activities that are supposedly harmful. It's kind of like some people embrace the idea of like COVID that was just ubiquitous and that was going to kill everyone, because then everyone is guilty.
Right.
And then you have the unlimited right to control them. You could lock them in their homes indefinitely because they're a threat. And so with CO2, it's, well, we all emit CO2 because we all not just breathe, but we use machines and all the machines involve fossil fuels. So if we're all a threat to the planet, that means there's an unlimited prerogative of the government to control us. And a lot of people like that idea.
And the threat is the key here, because before you can control a huge number of people, you first have to make them afraid, because they will respond to fear when they will not respond to anything else.
I think they also respond. I think fear and guilt are related.
Guilt and fear are, they're
because it's partially.
Yeah, they're intimately related, because if you're afraid of destroying the planet by your activities, me, I destroyed the planet because I'm breathing, right? Then that guilt is prompted by the fear of the planet being gone, right?
Yeah, exactly. So everyone is being told, hey, you're destroying the planet, so you have to be afraid of each of everyone else, including yourself in a sense. And then you also have to feel guilty mm-hmm. for your role in it, and certainly any protest, because if you protest, then they could say, oh, you're a denier, you don't care about the planet,
and as a result of you not caring, we don't have power over you. And that's what we really want, is we want to control your actions and your activities and your daily life, and we want you to cede that control to us. And in order for that to happen, we need to scare you. And it works, yep. man. It works. How many people wore the mask in 2020 and 2021, 22? How many people wore the mask because they were afraid? They behaved according to their fear. And fear is the basis of all of these interventions. It's everything makes you scared. You've got this Danish child running around all over the place talking about the planet boiling and all this other dog shit. What was the last thing here a couple of weeks ago? It's not a climate emergency now, it's a climate crisis. It's a crisis.
They're always changing the noun.
Yeah, we got to do different nouns, and you know, the adjectives are catastrophist, and everything is, you know, it's all designed to make you scared, make you afraid.
Let's just comment quickly on the names, because the name evolution is interesting. Even if you just start with climate change to then climate catastrophe or climate crisis or climate mm-hmm. emergency, climate change is itself a big problem. It's way too vague. Right, it's like, what do you mean? Change is inherent in climate, so there's no mm-hmm. such thing as climate non-change. So they're just deliberately taking a term that nobody can argue with. But then what they want you to mean is man-made climate catastrophe. So they say climate change, so everyone agrees, but then they interpret it as man-made climate catastrophe. So that was the first devious thing. But then they decided that wasn't effective enough. So we're just going to name the state of things a catastrophe. They're just going to say, oh, we have a climate emergency. And what that then prevents them from needing to argue anything. They just refer to a climate emergency like I would refer to my computer screen. Oh, that's a computer screen. Oh, there's a climate emergency.
Right.
So instead of having to make an argument.
If you could select
this is
that term.
Religious thing.
Oh, yeah, it is. If you could select the terminology, then you select the thinking about it.
Yes.
You know,
and you stop thinking about it because it's not even a question. No. Is it a crisis? And then people have no real evidence. It's just anecdotal. Oh, here someone died of this weather event. And you think, well, people used to die way more of weather events. So obviously no anecdote is evidence. But they've already committed on faith to, oh, we have an emergency. Now let's just talk about what to do about it. And guess what? That involves a lot of government control and a lot of restriction of fossil fuel use.
Right. Yeah. How many people 100 years ago died in hurricanes versus how many people die in hurricanes now?
I mean, it was much more common. That's just kind of common sense. But people, it's funny because people think it's worse than ever. But if you think about it for a second, would you rather live in the climate of 100 years ago with that level of technology and infrastructure versus today? I mean, you're literally 50 times safer from death now all the evidence we have than you used to be.
Oh, yeah. My parents grew up in North Texas in the early 1900s. Without a fan, you know, you can't imagine what it was like. You know, we can't imagine. We're air conditioning babies. We can't imagine what it was like. And people died all the time. People froze to death in the winter. They were uncomfortable as hell all summer. But, you know, instead of looking at that, what we are told, and this is the problem. The biggest problem, I see it from my standpoint, is we are told there are now, because of climate change, there are more hurricanes. So more people are going to die. And that is not true. That is not true. There are no more hurricanes now than there were 100 years ago. That is false. That is a false assertion. And that is repeated over and over and over again. They will say anything. They will lie about anything to make this climate emergency something that's not discussed. It's just accepted as a climate emergency because there's more hurricanes now. No, there aren't.
Well, but it's interesting you said there, because there are two portions of it, right? And I think both are false, but one is obviously false. So one is there's more hurricanes or more intense hurricanes, but then it's therefore we're in more danger. And right. Even if we had more and more intense hurricanes, we're clearly much less in danger
because,
than we were before.
Because now we know the hurricane is coming and we can move.
Well, that's one big thing, but also we can build much more resilient infrastructure.
Right. We know how to build against hurricanes now.
So that's what I stress the most. Like there's a certain category of thing where you have to study a lot of data to get it. And all of that kind of thing I give data for in Fossil Future. But for me, the most interesting thing is the interesting category of thing is the thing where you just think about it via common sense and it's obvious. And yet everyone is ignoring it. And right. One of these things is what I call climate mastery, that we're far better at neutralizing climate danger than we used to be. And clearly that improvement in climate mastery is far greater than any increase in climate challenges because we're obviously far safer. But people really treat it like it was much more of a climate emergency 100 years ago than today, and much more 200 years ago than 100 years ago. People used to live in perpetual climate emergency. That's why they invented all these climate gods. And that's why you could have millions of people wiped out from a drought and a famine. It's just a total disconnect from reality, but it's posing as science.
It is interesting that these people have been able to convince the general public that the sky is falling. The media has done an excellent job of doing their job. Their job is to increase the power of the government. And, you know, there's certain aspects of the media like us, me and you that are not, but the mainstream media has always been about doing the job of the propaganda arm of the government. And we've all decided that control must be ceded to the government because of global warming. And so what they have done is convince everybody that the world is going to end if the atmospheric fraction of CO2 goes up another 2%. That's just false. That's false. But they say it over and over and over again, and the lie repeated often enough becomes the truth, as Mr. Goebbels demonstrated to us in the 1940s.
I think it's interesting, this question of, because it's true absolutely that there's a lot of fear, and I think most disgustingly and prominently it's among children, where they really have the visceral fear, where people are being kept awake, and that's
the public schools have done their job of brainwashing these kids.
But I think there's an interesting phenomenon with the adults more and the leaders of this, where they're clearly not afraid of this the way that people were afraid of nuclear war or even of COVID, particularly if they were vulnerable. It's like this fear that everyone likes to say existential threat, crisis, emergency, but they don't feel it. They still fly around. They still do all this other stuff.
Yeah.
And I think in a sense, you can't believe it because you're not experiencing an emergency with climate because there isn't one. But I think that it relates to fear and guilt, because it does guilt everyone, because it's spread, even though people don't really feel it viscerally, they have the guilt that we're all causing it. And then that makes them compliant for a whole bunch of political control policies, and then actually a whole bunch of commercial green schemes of just like, oh, what do I do to be a good little boy? You know, okay, I buy a Prius, I buy a Tesla, I get rid of my, my gas heater. I have to get a heat pump. No gas stoves. I buy this green recycled thing. I don't use a plastic straw. It's just all these little stupid rituals that are really based on guilt. They're not actually, anyone thinks, oh, if only I use a paper straw, then the world is going to be great. It's like, it has a really religious guilt to it. And I think that's a dominant motive, and it leads to political submission and to commercial submission. Actually.
Did you see where the French, a couple of days ago, the French have, in a poll, the French people have concluded that we should only be able to take 4 airline flights in our lives.
I didn't see that. I've seen they've been limiting short trips. I mean, that's you look at the motive there of opposing flight, and you think about how many people have never flown, and what an amazing thing it is to fly. Just the experience. I mean, we were flying. My wife and I were flying the other day, and just occasionally, not enough, but we'll look outside and you just see how gorgeous. Just even being able to see the clouds at that level, and your ancestors never had a chance.
Oh yeah, it's cool.
But then, of course. You know, there
are aspects of it that are cool, I have to say. I'm not going to be treated that way by a waitress, so I don't fly commercial anymore. But it's fun to look at the clouds as the planes flying around in the sky. There's no doubt about it.
Well, and also just the ability to go. I mean, you know, we were visiting dear friends of ours who live in Austin, and we live in Southern California. And then, you know, then we can go there and do stuff we want and fly back and just make a weekend of it and get back to work. It's just amazing. And billions of people, I don't know the exact numbers, it must be at least 6 billion people, have never flown. And the whole focus is let's get rid of these cheap flights. Let's make it hard.
Let's make it harder for anybody to get anything done that doesn't increase our control over them. Our control over them must be total. And, you know, this is the underlying deal here between this and COVID and all this, all the shit that's going on now in 2023 is control must be absolute. And in order for control to be absolute, they must be afraid so they'll give us control, because we'll tell them that we will fix this. And there's nothing, you know what, you know how you know all of this is bullshit, Alex? Because we're not even allowed to talk about nuclear energy. We're not even allowed to have a discussion about nuclear power to generate electricity. There's no reason why we can't do that. It's been done, but nobody will even discuss it. And the fact that they're not discussing nuclear energy shows you that this is complete bullshit. All of this is about control.
Yeah, I think it's one of these cases where the thing they say they're concerned about clearly isn't the thing they're concerned about.
No.
Because if you were concerned about CO2 from a human perspective, so you're thinking, oh, well, I'm worried about the effects of more CO2. Well, then, but I still want as much energy as possible. Then you'd look at, well, what ways have we found to produce reliable energy at low cost that are scalable? And really, nuclear leads. I mean, hydro is amazing, but it doesn't work everywhere. It doesn't work on a fully global scale.
No.
But nuclear, we've had amazing results with, until the green movement increasingly regulated it to the point of criminalization, where it's just almost impossible to do anything. And there's still hostility. You'll occasionally have a climate catastrophist who will say, hey, why don't we use nuclear? And then the broader green community will
shut him down.
Jump on them.
Oh, yeah. They just, well, I mean, you can't use nuclear. That's what, I mean, Hiroshima.
Yeah,
right.
So they equate a nuclear plant. And although Fossil Futures is about fossil fuels, I have quite a bit about nuclear. And there's no, it's just so unforgivable that people treat a nuclear plant as a nuclear bomb, and they treat it as uniquely dangerous when it's actually uniquely safe. I agree. It's a very revealing thing that it's not really about the CO2. The CO2 is just, you can say it's one way to get control. I think that's ultimately true. But more directly, it's about thinking all human impact is bad. So CO2 is just one form of human impact they can scare us with and guilt us with.
Right.
But they're also against us splitting the atom. They're also against us building a dam. They're also against us mining for the materials and solar panels and wind turbines.
It's unless
all about
it's lithium.
The human impact
it's,
is bad.
It's okay to mine for lithium.
Well, but even
because
that is
because that goes in batteries, up. Right?
Well, but it's more like it's not okay in people's minds if they're seeing it. Lithium, a lot of the green stuff has been out of sight, out of mind. because it's happening largely in China and a lot of places that Africa, China has a lot of control over.
Places that are rich in minerals.
Right. And it's just not, but when people see it, so for example, we have this amazing deposit of minerals, a lot of which could be used for batteries and other things in Minnesota. And Biden just announced, 200,000 acres, that's off limits for 20 years. And just, so once the Greens see anything industrial, they oppose it.
Isn't that odd? This is, you know, if you're not cynical about damn near everything, then you're just not paying any attention, boys and girls. You're just not paying any attention. You know, I mean, if you want no CO2 to be emitted, there is no alternative to nuclear power. There is no alternative. We don't have nuclear fusion under control, and we probably never will. But we've got nuclear fission under control. We've had it under control for 70 years. And when was the last time an electric plant was built in the United States based on nuclear fission? Do you know, Alex?
We just had some completed, but it was, so the statistic I like is since the creation of the Nuclear Regulatory Commission, there went 47 years went by when no plant went from conception to completion.
Isn't that amazing? So
47 years, so 1975 basically to now, and the plants that have been completed in Georgia, they're just so ridiculously over budget. Because the regulatory environment is so crippling.
The regulatory environment is, once again, is the point. They want to control everything. And their version of regulating nuclear energy is to not have any.
Yeah, right. It's because if you can delay something indefinitely, you've effectively banned it.
Yes.
Like, I would never invest in a nuclear company under today's, even though I love nuclear technology, because you just know it can be delayed for 16 years.
You know, won't ever amortize. It will never amortize. You can't do it. You know, if you quintuple the most wild projections, and those are still too conservative, then why would anybody spend any money on that? You know, you're nuts if you do that. You're just absolutely nuts, and it's the government's fault.
Now, there is. I am an optimistic note. The last few years, I've been doing a lot more with elected officials, and people should check out. There's a free website called energytalkingpoints.com where you can get really good messaging and policy on pretty much any issue. There's also a newsletter you can sign up for, and I highly recommend it because we're about to release something called AlexGPT, which is a chat bot that answers everything as me based on my really extensive library of stuff. But this has been mostly for politicians. Now it's more for the general public as well. And I've gotten a lot of interest in new legislation about nuclear. So I have some stuff in the works improving nuclear. So there are politicians who are interested in it and changing a lot of these things. So I just think, but my point is we need radical change. If we didn't get one plant going from conception to completion for 47 years, you can't just tinker around the edges. You need radical policy reform.
No, that is a systemic problem. And it has to be solved, but it's going to have to be solved by people who are intensely disinterested in solving it. It's, I don't know what you do. You get rid of the nuclear regulatory agencies.
I think the two things schematically you can do are either the federal body needs to be radically reformed and or it needs to be at the state level. At least states should be able to opt out of the federal and do it. But you need, we had an Atomic Energy Commission before the Nuclear Regulatory Commission. It's not like we had nothing, but the Atomic Energy Commission was actually focused on nuclear energy as a good thing. Let's help it spread cheaply and safely. Nuclear Regulatory Commission, its mission is to say, let's minimize only nuclear risk. So let's make nuclear have no risk, which nothing has no risk. So what you do is, and there's a lot of pseudoscience involved in how they do it, but what you do is you just create higher risk because if you try to get rid of the thing that has the lowest risk, then you just do things with higher risk. So they hold nuclear to a million times the standard of any other form of energy. You know, and so they regulate it out of existence.
I remember watching 60 Minutes one Sunday afternoon about 35 years ago. And it's probably been about that long since I've actually watched television. But they had a segment on 60 Minutes about nuclear waste. And this whole segment, I think I've talked about this on the podcast before, but I think it's worth repeating. If your objection to nuclear energy is the nuclear waste generated by the reactors, there is a perfectly viable way to deal with that. And what they do is, if you take spent nuclear rods and you chop them up and bury them in concrete, mix them into concrete, and then you form the concrete into a plug that is shaped like a torpedo with a pointy nose and fins on the back, and you put these heavy concrete radioactive things on the back of a ship. And you drive the ship out into the middle of the Pacific Ocean, and you drop these shaped plugs of concrete and nuclear waste into the water. And it goes down through 20,000 feet of water and embeds itself into the ooze on the bottom of the ocean floor, the deep abyssal plain. In the ocean floor, it's buried now under 20 feet of ooze. And for all practical purposes, it is gone. It will be subducted 55 million years from now. It'll be absorbed into a subduction zone into the mantle of the Earth. But in terms of being accessible, it's gone. In terms of being radioactive for any purpose, it's gone. It's buried in 20 feet of mud in a completely inaccessible place. There is a way, there is no excuse to not have nuclear reactors making energy. If you're concerned about the nuclear waste, it's a non-issue. And it's been, and this is 35 years ago I saw this. And but what do? They want to put it in a canyon, in a cave, in the most tectonically active spot in the continental United States, out in Nevada, in the Basin and Range out there where there are earthquakes all the time. That's where they want to put it, instead of out in the middle of the Pacific Ocean in international waters. It's just bizarre to me. There is another agenda here. There's always another agenda. Who doesn't want nuclear energy is the question. And where's the money?
Well, I think one thing I hope people who check out Fossil Future, Chapter 3 in particular, talks a lot about incentives. And I think there is a part of my analysis is I always look at where's the philosophy, not just where's the money. Where's the money is important, mm-hmm. but where's the philosophy? Right. And people really, particularly the leaders of this movement, have a deep hostility toward human impact on nature. They just think it's wrong for us to impact nature. And you see this with nuclear. Right. Nuclear is the cleanest, safest form of energy. There are numerous ways of dealing safely with nuclear waste, including we just have it in pools outside nuclear power plants. It works just fine. It's very compact. It's in a sense the least problematic waste. It doesn't end up in your lungs at all. It doesn't explode. They always find a reason to oppose things. But when you refute the reason, they still oppose it. And it's the same thing. There's no interest. You know, they say, oh, we hate fossil fuels because of CO2. And then you say, okay, but let's look into nuclear. No. We can't do nuclear because of the waste. Oh, you refute the waste. We can't do nuclear because of the safety. Oh, you refute that. And then there's always an excuse.
Yeah, we just don't want to. is the excuse. Because
it involves impact. They think it's wrong. Anything that makes our modern high impact civilization possible, there's this hostility too. And they invent these reasons that will resonate with us. But for them, the reason is they just think it's evil.
It's a little late for that, boys and girls. We've impacted things already. And over the past years, past 50 years or so, our impact has lessened and we've improved things that we used to fuck up. We've improved things. The air is cleaner now than it was 50 years ago, despite the fact that there's twice as many of us now. And the reason the air is cleaner is because we are able to use fossil fuels and power this society for twice as many people much, much more efficiently than we did previously.
It's really you look at it. I mean, I would say we've lessened our negative impacts, our unhealthy impacts. And that's really what can continue. That's why I say fossil future is we don't have anything close to fossil fuels for the next several decades, at least in terms of being able to provide low cost, reliable energy for every type of machine and purpose.
Right. Especially if we're not allowed to make it, which is.
Yeah, well, billions of people in thousands of places. So we can, just like when I was born in 1980, like if you compare now to then, it's a much better world overall. We're safer from climate. Yeah. Everything is better overall, insofar as we've been free. The past couple of years have been particularly anti-freedom, and that's actually finally causing some regression. But in general, it's been a very progressive thing in the proper sense of the word, in terms of the world becoming a better place for human life. And we can continue to do that, but we need to shed all these terrible ways of thinking that are ultimately anti-human and also anti-freedom. And but I do think it's possible, and I highly encourage people not only check out the book, but energytalkingpoints.com, because that'll give you the raw material to persuade a lot of other people.
When I was a little boy, before all of this anti-nuclear shit started cascading down from the media, there was talk of the development of household-sized nuclear reactors. You probably don't remember that, but the talking points back then were that everybody will essentially be off the grid because you can plug into your own little tiny portable nuclear reactor, which they were talking about developing at the time, and having electricity provided by that. But, see, instead, now we have to burn coal and natural gas, and we have to litter the landscape with these idiotic-ass wind turbines and solar panels in order to do what nuclear can do without those climate impacts. But we're not even allowed to have a discussion about it. That's how you know these people are not serious about this. They're not serious about it.
Well, fortunately, we're able to have the discussion at least somewhere, wherever you're able to.
Well, you and I are, and all of the thousands and thousands of people watching this need to be made aware of the fact that alternatives exist that make perfect sense. But that our betters are not allowing us to pursue.
I would say they exist, but you need radical policy changes for them to really develop. They've been nuclear's been stagnating for decades.
Decades.
So it's not like we can just turn off fossil fuels in 10 years and turn on nuclear, but we can at least liberate nuclear now so that it can start to grow to its potential. Sure. That applies to anything that's cost effective. I'm for anything that's cost effective, but I'm not for forcibly preventing us from using the thing that's cost effective now and then promising us, somehow sunshine and wind will work. If you think that's true, you offer them on a free market and produce reliable, low cost energy, and then I'll be happy to buy it.
Right. Right now, Texas is got a big, gigantic amount of wind power going up all over the place. And the damn things, every single one of those wind turbines are essentially 100% paid for by the federal government. They do not amortize. They do not generate enough electricity over the course of their really relatively short lifespan to pay for themselves.
No, they're hugely subsidized. The main thing is they don't provide reliable electricity, no. So they're really parasites. Yeah, Texas is a mess.
Fossil Future argues that we need to be thankful and embrace the potential of fossil fuel because of its ability to generate energy that mitigates any harms that might be produced by that use. And I think the book makes an excellent case for that. It's a long, dense book. Alex has done a whole bunch of research here, and you guys need to read this thing. Fossil Future, it's on Amazon. That's where I got mine, is Amazon. And you guys need to get in the middle of that and see exactly what his argument is, and then talk about it. Talk about it amongst yourselves. Why don't you? Alex, thank you very much. Alex Epstein has been our guest today on Starting Strength Radio, and we will see you guys next time. Thanks.